Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Every town throughout their history has that mythical character, that mythical figure that you just don't know if it's real. Most people call that guy the Paul Bunyan of their town. Well, we have a Paul Bunyan of Kansas City. His name is Old Pino. It's time to find out what one of the most mythical characters in Kansas City had going on in his life, and if he truly was for real. Well, I said in the intro, it's like a real-life Kansas City version of Paul Bunyan. But the more I think about it, Diane, this Old Pino dude is more like Bill Brasky from Saturday Night Live. Do you remember the old Bill Brasky skits? I know Bill Brasky. He once ate 10 shrimp cocktails and, you know, went out and drove a car with his arm and then flipped it and carried the car away. Like, all of these, like, stories about Bill Brasky are out there. And I feel like that's kind of the case with Old Pino, who... 124 years old is how old he was when he died. I don't know that I'm buying this story.
I don't know if I buy it either, but God, it makes for a good story, right? This is when we get into Kansas City folklore versus Kansas City's history. We have to look at it and think, what would have caused somebody to engrave on a headstone, to be clear, in St. Mary's Cemetery, originally in the Catholic Cemetery downtown, moved later to St. Mary's Cemetery, have it literally say, this J. Pino Fornes died July 17th, 1871, aged 124 years. Like they put that in stone because it was such an impressive thing. People wanted to believe you could live long lives. And back then in the 1870s, long life certainly wasn't even 80s would have been old, right? So 124, like you're a legend. And this guy was, essentially a legend, but it was fun trying to figure out who was he, who, what can we prove? Because I have to, as a historian, prove the facts or look at the facts. And then also look at how maybe the conjecture would have occurred that old Pino was almost, over a century old plus a quarter of a century.
Well, I mean, 124 is old today. I mean, if somebody reaches that kind of stage today, you're like, oh my gosh, they've lived a very long and full life. But this guy, I mean, the stories that this guy has told or has been part of, or however we want to phrase it, are unbelievable. Like, he was a Canadian that was born allegedly before America was a country. And then at some point in his life, walked from Canada to the United States. And like, that's just the beginning of who this guy is. So he's walking across from Canada to the United States to make a better life for himself, I guess.
Yeah. So his story, good point. So he says, and apparently a lot of people, you can imagine this guy was single and never got married. He's an old mountain man. So, and there's no pictures of him. So we have to use our imagination. He looks exactly like you're picturing right now. It's probably, just like old and hard life. Sun, drenched skin that's now wrinkled he probably looked old at 40, to be clear, which is probably what led to these, these stories of him, being so old, and he probably just rolled with it. But in the same token, if you were uneducated and he was a devout Catholic, but if you were uneducated, why did you need to know your age? Back then, you didn't need it for your driver's license. You didn't need it for a passport. You didn't need it to prove that you could work legally. You just were what you were. And so he probably didn't know how old he was, to be fair, but he did tell stories that he puts himself, this is what he puts himself out mending a fence on his father's farm when the Battle of Quebec broke out in 1759. Mm-hmm. So if you're mending a fence, you got to be able to hold a hammer. You know what I mean? He's not diapers. So it's like, okay. And then people would question him. Now, remember, not educated, but people would question him. Educated people would question him. And his facts all added up. So they thought, well, it's true, because he, now was he told those stories and then remembered it? I mean, who knows? But the fact of the matter is, people really did believe he had such a memory of this that it was true. He also said some other things, or in the paper, it was documented. The man couldn't read or write, so it was all secondhand information. But he said he was part of the Lewis and Clark expedition.
And I wanted to, I wanted to get to that. I wanted to kind of say, all right, so he walks to America, claiming
he walks to America,
fighting, you know, in the French Revolution in Canada or whatever it was. Then decides, you know what, I've done enough of this. I'm going to walk to America, and then I'm going to join up with Lewis and Clark. And that's when you start to go, all right, maybe Mr. Not. Brasky, Mr. Paul Bunyan here, what kind of more tall tales are we saying? Were you involved in the Louisiana Purchase? Did you fight in the Civil War as well as the American Revolution War? Like, what do we got going on here? So the first, like, kind of like, moment for me was like, I was with Lewis and Clark. That never really added up, did it?
No, it didn't. And so he said, so he said he walked from Quebec to Pittsburgh. Which is possible. I mean, if you didn't have the money,
possible
he walked. I mean,
You know how long Quebec to Pittsburgh is? We're not talking like walking like from, you know, Kansas City to Independence or something like that. We're talking about a journey that could take years on foot.
Well, it would feel that way, but that's all people did was walk. You couldn't afford a horse. That was your car. Yeah. And, you know, like, I'm gonna remind you that during, like, in Kansas City, when, during the Civil War, when everybody was evacuated, a woman walked all the way to Texas. It happened.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people were a lot tougher than we are today.
No doubt.
I wouldn't even walk to Independence. I mean, it would have to be like desperate times. But
most people don't like walking across the street anymore. Where am I going to park? I need my car. Yeah.
Seriously. That's why I avoid downtown. Mm. So yeah, in any case, he says that he, moves to St. Louis. So he goes from Pittsburgh, and then he gets on a flatboat on the Mississippi River, and he rolls all the way down to New Orleans.
But how does he get from Pittsburgh to the headwaters of the Mississippi to get on this flatbed to get to where he needs to go?
I have no idea. Nobody ever asked. Or if they didn't ask those questions, then it wasn't documented, at least in anything I can find. He's one of those I'm going to keep on my radar, because I'd love to figure out a little bit more about him. But he says that he goes down to New Orleans. So he's up, first he goes, says he was with the Lewis and Clark expedition, which doesn't add up for a couple different reasons. And this actually happens after he's in New Orleans, he says, but it doesn't add up partially because that expedition is very exceptional in the fact that there's a lot of documents for it. There are pay records, there are diaries from multiple people there. I mean, it was a government contract. Mm-hmm. So you have in order to be paid, you have to be on a list. He's not on any list. So that's kind of, I mean, I'm telling you, although a lovely story, that's a story.
Yeah.
Now, but he did say he goes down to, during the War of 1812, he ends up in New Orleans. He floats on down to New Orleans.
Is this Forrest Gump we're talking about? Like, are we going to see him like at meeting John Kennedy and being part of a great football team years later? Because that's kind of where I feel like
we're trying. It does feel like that. It's the exceptional life of Forrest Gump, minus the fact that he never became rich, you know.
Right.
So, and also, you know, that's an exception. I say it was an exceptional tale in the fact that they did such a good job weaving together historical events, making him a part of them.
Yeah.
In circumstance or happenstance. But he ends up in New Orleans, and he says that Andrew Jackson at this point is in control of New Orleans. It's the War of 1812, and he says he wants to enlist, but they told him he was too old. In 1812.
Well, in 1812, if you're born in the 1750s, I mean, you're 60 some years old.
Well, for whatever the reason, and the guy would have had, and to be fair to Kansas City and really the people that were exploring, like, and I'm talking westward expansion exploring, although we have people like Jim Bridger who are not French Canadian, most of these guys have French Canadian roots. So including Old Pino, who is no doubt born in Quebec, that we can say with a fact, you know. Yes. And his first name was Jack, essentially, you know, the American pronunciation. But people never knew his name. It was kind of one of those things that later came up that it was like, oh yeah, this is my actual name. But he ends up in St. Louis and he meets a guy there. And this is true. So now we're like, we don't know about all this other stuff, but this part we know is true, is that he meets a guy named Andrew Drips. And he was born in 1789, died in 1860. Andrew Drips was born in Pennsylvania. He actually served in the War of 1812, legit. And then he moves to St. Louis, where he becomes part of the Missouri Fur Company. And he's also stationed, so he's stationed near Bellevue, Nebraska. So just like most of these traders and trappers of the time, he ends up marrying a Native American woman named, an Oto woman named Mary, mm-hmm. in 1822. We have to assume, because Andrew Drips is his best friend, we have to assume that where Andrew Drips we know is, so is Old Pino, you know, like he was kind of in tow.
Right.
And so I had to follow Andrew Drips' life then. And he was, you know, he's a pretty important early Kansas Cityan, if you will. So in 1830, Andrew Drips joins the Western branch of the American Fur Company that's owned by John Jacob Astor. Okay. So he goes out west and they're trading and trapping, and we know he has Old Pino with him. So what was interesting, they're stationed mostly in Idaho, in like southeast Idaho, really near where my sister-in-law actually is from. And they had a rivalry at the time with the American Fur Company. And that is, what's interesting about this is that's owned and operated by like Jim Bridger, Thomas Fitzpatrick, Milton Sublette, which is William Sublette's brother. These are founders of Kansas City. I mean, mm-hmm. these are guys, Jim Bridger like ended up retiring in Kansas City. And the fact that there's like this connection, they all end up in Kansas City later, is pretty interesting. So they're in we're talking 1830, like Kansas City's not even a town yet.
Right.
And they're in rivalry. So what they used to do is they would have a rendezvous point where people would know to take the wagons so they could get supplies for their, you know, expeditions. And this rendezvous point on Powder River was in Pierre's Hole. So we're still in the Idaho area. It happens in July, 1832. We know for a fact that Andrew Drips is there, and so is his Old Pino character. And he makes it on the pay records at this point. So they end up actually having to work together, these two fur companies, because they're attacked by a Native American tribe. They thought it was the Blackfoot. The Blackfoot were super violent. And so they go after him. And it was actually this tribe called the Gros Ventres. And there's this huge battle that happens. It's the largest, I think, battle with Native Americans that happens at this point in history. 26 Native Americans are killed, and at least a dozen or so traders and trappers are gone. Andrew Drips fights in it. Jim Bridger fights in it. Old Pino's there fighting in it. I mean, it's crazy. So we know that for a fact. And what's interesting is the day after this battle, like just coincidentally, the Oto bride of Andrew Drips, Mary, ends up having a child. She is pregnant. She ends up having a child named Catherine the day after this battle. And Catherine ends up being Old Pino's like best little friend. He calls her ma petite Catherine. So my mm-hmm. little Catherine, he's holding her, carrying her around camp. Like he loves this little girl. And it's kind of odd that it happens the day after one of the only documented things we have about this guy's life.
Right. You know? It's crazy. But I mean, it's also like he's borrowing stories from so many different people and combining them all into one to kind of become his story. And so he doesn't go with Lewis and Clark. He ends up with a fur trading company. But then one of the stories that I found just fascinating is he claims to have broken a leg and to have crawled 22 miles in 20 days to get back to where he needed to go. Another kind of tall tale that this guy is telling people and letting people know about that may or may not be true. So did he crawl to Kansas City? How did he end up getting here?
Well, and that's an interesting point that you put. Did you see The Revenant, the movie The Revenant?
I have not, no.
Oh my God, Bob, you have, okay, that put that
There's
on
a lot of movies that I have to see. I need to see Top Gun. I need to see
Oh My God.
Dancing. I need to see a lot of these movies that I'm just not a movie guy. I never have been. I don't think I ever will be.
I'm not a huge, I don't waste a lot of my time, you know, watching, you know, these type of these types of programs or watching movies. I haven't been to a movie in years. Mm-hmm. But like, and I mean,
no, I did see the Kurt Warner movie a couple of weeks ago in Chicago, and that was very good. I was really, really like surprised how good it was.
Oh, well, see, so you can sit down. This, The Revenant's a little long, so get yourself, you know, some of your vodka.
Yeah, right. And a notepad to keep track of who's who.
And your spirit mixers. Yep. Gave me the Moscow Mule. Mm-hmm. So The Revenant is an incredible story, and it's based in the same time period, and it is based on a true story, and it also involves these traders and trappers. The reason I bring it up is I know a lot of our people that listen have seen it. It is an incredible story of a man who shouldn't have lived. He shouldn't have survived. He was left for dead. And he was able to survive. It was rough out there. Like, so to say 22 miles and walking, yeah, it sounds ridiculous, but I don't know. I think that there's probably some method of truth to this one. So the story goes as this, and this story was told, is documented in newspaper accounts, and it's also documented in Father Bernard Donnelly, who was the first, you know, resident Catholic preacher or priest in Kansas City, met old Pino in 1845, by the way, said at that point, he was told he was over 100 years old.
See, but if he was born in 1750, then 1845, he's not 100. The math doesn't.
He said he's about 100 years old. Yeah. That's what he said. Now, again, to be fair, too, Bernard Donnelly didn't know when he was born either. So, yeah. You know, here we go again. So anyway.
But he doesn't have any tall tales that he's, you know, spinning out there about, you know, building a fence in Montreal and ending up finding Kansas City.
It is a lie, or I should say it's a send a lie, isn't it, Bob? Mm-hmm. But, and remember, old Pino was super Catholic. So I really don't think he didn't know. I mean, maybe he was a little had Alzheimer's or something. Sure. I don't know. So here's what happens. So he meets him around 1845 and he's introduced to him as old Pino. Like, hey, dude, this is old Pino. Meet old Pino. And of course, Bernard is like, hey, old Pino, what's up? So he meets him and he notices immediately he walks with this crazy limp, and he says that his legs like don't seem to want to work together. That's kind of how it's described. So he, of course, later learns the story, and he's told that he's working for Drips, Andrew Drips, in the Black Hills. Totally, probably true. And he sees a buffalo. So he hides and he gets his gun out, boom, shoots the buffalo. Like, yeah, cool. Got me some meat for a while. Well, the buffalo goes after him. Sorry, this is funny, but in my head I'm picturing this. So the buffalo goes after old Pino and attacks him, and I love it because the story even says that old Pino, you know, used the old trick of playing dead, so he just like lays down and plays dead. But the buffalo is not fooled, so no. He goes after him and ends up breaking his leg below the knee in two different spots. And so he passes out from the pain, wakes up, and he's shocked to find that he actually had killed the buffalo with one shot. So it just the buffalo's reaction was to attack its aggressor, if you will. So at that point, he wakes up and he's like, great, I can't walk. What am I going to do? So he takes his knife out and he uses it to cut down a sapling, and he creates like, you know, essentially, you know, a splint, and then uses his rifle as a crutch. So he either walked or crawled, you know, probably took turns doing both, to back to camp. It said he was 20 miles from camp, and it said it took him 22 days to get there. That's a mile a day.
It's absolutely insane. And then went 6 days without eating, you know, yeah. During like this stuff. Like this guy truly survived and maybe really saw it all at that point in time, right? He experienced everything you possibly could experience. But he finally gets to Kansas City, and he's here, obviously, right before Kansas City truly becomes Kansas City. Mm-hmm. When we look at old Pino, what kind of impact, what kind of, mm-hmm. Effect did he have on the founding of our town? Like, why is he important for the history of this city, I guess?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know if he was important. He was, but he's one of those that, because of my job as a historian, is to tell you the stories you've never heard, right?
Right.
Not focusing always on these people we've heard of and finding these elusive characters that are certainly characters. I think he's important. There's a couple things here. Finding documentation, and we'll talk about that here in just a few, finding documentation for this is very difficult. So to know what his impact was is pretty difficult. But what we do know is this. By 1834, Pierre Choteau, of course, Kansas City, here we go, right. Has bought the interest of the American Fur Company. And so by 1839, P- Pino, old Pino, is listed as an employee. At this point, he would have been, according to records, if you will, 90 years old, whatever. So there's a connection right there to Kansas City. Andrew Drips ends up by 1840 settling in the West Bottoms, which were called the French Bottoms, mm-hmm. if you will, with all these French Canadian Catholics. And of course, we have to assume old Pino's with him, right? He's still doting on, you know, Ma Petite Catherine and all of this. And so he moves to the West Bottoms and then they flood. And so in 1846, Andrew Drips buys 40 acres of land, you know, way out in the middle of nowhere at 13th and Cherry.
And that's way out south back then.
Actually, it was 13th and Summit. Yeah, way out south, 13th and Summit. He ends up buying 40 acres and building a log cabin. And in 1853, so Andrew Drips is super important to Kansas City's history because he's a very well-known national character. We might not read about him in our history books today, but he was a name that you heard back then. So it wasn't a Kansas City name. It was a American name, mm-hmm. an American historical narrative that would happen. So Catherine ends up marrying a guy named William Mulkey in 1853, and they settle, you know, on the same land, whatever. And William Mulkey is a character because he owns a saloon and he ends up making lots of money as a gambler. He gambled horse racing, which is interesting. So in 1857, Catherine and her husband, who have no children of their own, they do, but it's a long story. So in 1857, they build a large brick home on this Drips land. And they're like, they built a special room for old Pino because, you know, Catherine, it's like her adopted dad, if you will. Mm-hmm. He refuses to sleep inside. And what Father Donnelly wrote is he had slept for so many years under the stars or in a hut of his own building that he could not sleep in a room with plastered walls. Thus, old Pino lived in the small log cabin in their garden.
That's insane.
He was just used to roughing it.
Yeah.
So it was like, this is where I'm going to live. And his life, he just, as he got, I mean, already old, you know, he's already old. He went to mass every day. Mm-hmm. So Father Donnelly became very close to him. He would tend to a vegetable garden. He had berry bushes, tobacco plants, and he was super neat in his appearance, although he had his limp. He was just kind of there. People knew him and adored him and all of that. And then one day he got real sick. So Andrew Drips had died by 1860. So Catherine is his family. Mm-hmm. And so Father Donnelly has sent a message that from Catherine saying, come quickly to my house. And so he goes there in 1871. He goes there and to give him last rites. And essentially, you know, he's dying. He comes back the next day and he doesn't find him in the home. And this is just such a sweet story. So he's walking through the orchard. This is Father Donnelly. And he writes about this. And he sees what he calls the most genuine tenderness and simplicity he had never seen before. And what he finds is old Pino laying on the lap of Catherine and she's Aww. Stroking his head. And, you know, he's looking up at her and he's dying. And he died in her arms in the garden where it, you know, where he loved and spent his last days. And then, of course, it made the papers, you know, big story because he was 124 years old. And so then, of course, there's all these accounts like Van Horn, Robert Van Horn. He writes about him and talks about all the stories that old Pino told him. And so it becomes kind of a sensational thing. And sometimes this happens. Someone's life doesn't even seem that sensational or exceptional until after they're dead. And then it's too late. You can't ask him any questions anymore.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote Robert Van Horn asking like 124 years old. That seems a little suspicious. And so they asked, did he drink? Did he use tobacco? And did he have high morals when it came to women?
Oh.
And Van Horn went to his doctor, Dr. Thorpe, and said, hey, buddy, answer these questions for this guy. He wants to know, you know, how do you live a long life? This is what, you know, we said that he drank, or they're asking if he drank, if he used tobacco and had morals. And the doctor wrote back this, quote, he smoked and chewed tobacco constantly. He never missed a chance to take a drink and got drunk as often as he could. He always had a squaw, and when he could afford it, had two or three. So don't take that for a longevity of life, people. probably not true.
Definitely not today, but I mean, if you got to look at, like, the, you know, the Paul Bunyan and the Babe Blue Ox of Kansas City, we found our guy.
I know. Pino.
And good for you, old Pino, for living to 124. I don't think I want to be that old.
No, I mean, and here's the thing. So then I have to look at this as a historian, right? So old Pino, great guy, Jack Fornace, if you will. Mm-hmm. First thing I'm looking for are birth records. So I've got access to these types of things. And I have access to a translator, thank God, because I don't read the French. So right. I've got, you know, people looking for me, whatever. I did find someone with that name, and he's baptismal record. And the guy was born in 1785. So that would have made him 85, 86 when he died. Mm-hmm. Assuming it's him. Now, the name is not common, but it's not like Diane Houston uncommon, if that will, you know. But so that was kind of hopeful. I'm like, okay, well, that would make more sense. And if the guy lived such a hard life, the guy slept outside all the time. Maybe, you know, maybe. So the other thing I looked at were old accounts, diaries, and things like that. That was something that would never been done before. So I actually found a diary that was written in, you know, at the time period by a guy named Warren. Like his first name was Warren Ferris. The guy, his diary wasn't published until 1940, but it was written in from 1830 to 1835. And in it, he devotes quite a lot to old Pino and even explains how he got his nickname. He said that old Pino got it, that all the French Canadian traders and trappers had nicknames, and his was old Pino, which Pino, I mean, if you look up, if looking for a translation, is like pine, like a pine tree, which
I thought it was wine. I thought it was
Pinot Noir, yeah. Which didn't even exist back then. But yeah. And Pinot, by the way, for those of you who want to look it up, is P-I-N-O. Yeah. So in any case, so, okay. So he made an impression on a young trader, even in 1830, who called him super old then. So again, I'm like, well, okay, maybe. And he writes a whole story about how they almost got killed by Native Americans, and they found old Pino by the river, and he started crying. And I mean, that is primary source documentation. And he calls him old then. So at that point, he would have been 45 years old. If you go by this baptismal record, that ain't old. So I don't have an answer here about that. So then I looked at census records, 1850. He's not in any earlier census records because the dude was traveling all over the place. He wasn't stationary. So, you know, I can't find him otherwise. And also he was traveling to places that weren't technically states yet. So there are no census records. So in 1850, he says he's 60. Okay, reasonable.
Sure. Like
1790 is when you are born. And then 1860, so 10 years later, he's now 74. So he's added on 4 years. Okay. All right. And then in 1870, that's when things just really hit the fan. He's 109. He's listed as 109 years old.
This is fantastic. I'm finally glad we got the official story of our friend Jerry Anselmo.
Exactly. No one can ever really pinpoint the age or the mission of said person. Yeah, I mean, who knows? I think that we have to go back to the fact to remember that life back then was a lot more difficult. Life back then was a lot more complicated in some regard. There was no need to know when you were born. There was no need to have that. And even in 1871, the fact that he made it into Father Donnelly's record of death. And, you know, in his record of death, he even puts in parentheses his real name, which he had only learned, you know, a few years earlier. That was a pretty early record for Kansas City death, 1871, and he made sure to record it with his nickname and everything else. And so you take it for this. The guy got moved. He's buried in Andrew Dripps' plot. So he's buried with Andrew Dripps and his wife in a mm-hmm. beautiful monument. He's moved from downtown Kansas City, from the original Catholic cemetery to the new Catholic cemetery, which is now the old Catholic cemetery, St. Mary's. He's there, and for, you know, the rest of, hopefully forever and ever, assuming it holds up, that headstone's going to read that somebody is 124 years old, and he's a French Canadian Catholic who was super devoted, you know, and c'est la vie, old Pino. That's life. whatever it is, it is.
Well, that's the story of old Pino. Obviously, nobody knows for sure how old he was, what he actually experienced, but his stories are really, really awesome. And if half of them are true, I think we found ourselves a pretty cool, original Kansas City.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.